way. It went into action a little to the right of his battalion, and as the shot from the first rifled piece boomed through the mist, the cannon from the fortifications opened with a mighty roar. An officer galloped by, shouting something which Trent did not catch, but he saw the ranks in front suddenly part company with his own and disappear in the twilight. More officers rode up and stood beside him, peering into the fog. Away in front, the crackling had become one prolonged crash. It was dreary, waiting. Trent chewed some bread for the man behind, who tried to swallow it, and after a while shook his head, motioning Trent to eat the rest himself. A corporal offered him a little brandy, and he drank it. But when he turned around to return the flask, the corporal was lying on the ground. Alarmed, he looked at the soldier next to him, who shrugged his shoulders and opened his mouth to speak, but something struck him and he rolled over and over into the ditch below. At that moment the horse of one of the officers gave a bound and backed into the battalion, lashing out with his heels. One man was ridden down, another was kicked in the chest and hurled through the ranks. The officer sank his spurs into the horse and forced him to the front again, where he stood trembling. The cannonade seemed to grow nearer. A staff officer, riding slowly up and down the battalion, suddenly collapsed in his saddle and clung to his horse's mane. One of his boots dangled, crimsoned and dripping from the stirrup. Then, out of the mist in front, men came running. The roads, the fields, the ditches were full of them, and many of them fell. For an instant he imagined he saw horsemen riding about like ghosts in the vapors beyond, and a man behind him cursed horribly, declaring he too had seen them, and that they were Uhlans. But the battalion stood inactive, and the mist fell again over the meadows. The colonel sat heavily upon his horse, his bullet-shaped head buried in the astrakhan collar of his dolman, his fat legs sticking straight out in the stirrups. The buglers clustered about him with bugles poised, and behind him a staff officer in a pale blue jacket smoked a cigarette and chatted with a captain of hussars. From the road in front came the sound of furious galloping, and an orderly reined up beside the colonel, who motioned him to the rear without turning his head. Then on the left a confused murmur arose which ended in a shout. A hussar passed like the wind, followed by another and another, and then squadron after squadron whirled by them into the sheeted mists. At that instant the colonel reared in his saddle, the bugles clanged, and the whole battalion scrambled down the embankment, over the ditch, and started across the soggy meadow. Almost at once Trent lost his cap. Something snatched it from his head. He thought it was a tree branch. A good many of his comrades rolled over in the slush and ice, and he imagined that they had slipped. One pitched right across his path, and he stopped to help him up, but the man screamed when he touched him, and an officer shouted, "Forward! Forward!" So he ran on again. It was a long jog through the mist, and he was often obliged to shift his rifle. When at last they lay panting behind the railroad embankment, he looked about him. He had felt the need of action, of a desperate physical struggle of killing and crushing. He had been seized with a desire to fling himself among masses and tear right and left. He longed to fire, to use the thin, sharp bayonet on his chassepot. He had not expected this. He wished to become exhausted, to struggle and cut until incapable of lifting his arm. Then he had intended to go home. He heard a man say that half the battalion had gone down in the charge, and he saw another examining a corpse under the embankment. The body, still warm, was clothed in a strange uniform. But even when he noticed the spiked helmet lying a few inches further away, he did not realize what had happened. The colonel sat on his horse a few feet to the left, his eyes sparkling under the crimson kepi. Trent heard him reply to an officer, "I can hold it, but another charge, and I won't have enough men left to sound a bugle." "Were the Prussians here?" Trent asked of a soldier who sat wiping the blood trickling from his hair.
"Yes, the hussars cleaned them out. We caught their crossfire."
"We are supporting a battery on the embankment," said another. Then the battalion crawled over the embankment and moved along the lines of twisted rails. Trent rolled up his trousers and tucked them into his woolen socks, but they halted again, and some of the men sat down on the dismantled railroad track. Trent looked for his wounded comrade from the Beaux-Arts. He was standing in his place, very pale. The cannonade had become terrific. For a moment the mist lifted. He caught a glimpse of the 1st Battalion motionless on the railroad track in front, of regiments on either flank, and then, as the fog settled again, the drums beat, and the music of the bugles began away on the extreme left. A restless movement passed among the troops. The colonel threw up his arm. The drums rolled. The battalion moved off through the fog. They were near the front now, for the 1st Battalion was firing as it advanced. Ambulances galloped along the base of the embankment to the rear, and the hussars passed and repassed like phantoms. They were in the front at last, for all about them was movement and turmoil, while from the fog close at hand came cries and groans and crashing volleys. Shells fell everywhere, bursting along the embankment, splashing them with frozen slush. Trent was frightened. He began to dread the unknown, which lay there, cracking and flaming in obscurity. The shock of the cannon sickened him. He could even see the fog light up with a dull orange as the thunder shook the earth. It was near, he felt certain, for the colonel shouted, "Forward!" and the 1st Battalion was hastening into it. He felt its breath. He trembled, but hurried on. A fearful discharge in front terrified him. Somewhere in the fog men were cheering, and the colonel's horse, streaming with blood, plunged about in the smoke. Another blast and shock right in his face almost stunned him, and he faltered. All the men to the right were down. His head swam. The fog and smoke stupefied him. He put out his hand for a support and caught something. It was the wheel of a gun carriage, and a man sprang from behind it, aiming a blow at his head with a rammer, but stumbled back, shrieking, with a bayonet through his neck, and Trent knew that he had killed. Mechanically, he stooped to pick up his rifle, but the bayonet was still in the man who lay beating with his red hands against the sod. It sickened him, and he leaned on the cannon. Men were fighting all around him now, and the air was foul with smoke and sweat. Somebody seized him from behind, and another in front. But others in turn seized them or struck them solid blows. The click, click, click of bayonets infuriated him, and he grasped the rammer and struck out blindly until it was shivered to pieces. A man threw his arm around his neck and bore him to the ground, but he throttled him and raised himself on his knees. He saw a comrade seize the cannon and fall across it with his skull crushed in. He saw the colonel tumble clean out of his saddle into the mud, then consciousness fled. When he came to himself, he was lying on the embankment among the twisted rails. On every side huddled men who cried out and cursed and fled away into the fog, and he staggered to his feet and followed them. Once he stopped to help a comrade with a bandaged jaw who could not speak but clung to his arm for a time, and then fell dead in the freezing mire. And again he aided another, who groaned, "Trent, c'est moi, Philippe," until a sudden volley in the mist relieved him of his charge. An icy wind swept down from the heights, cutting the fog into shreds. For an instant, with an evil leer, the sun peered through the naked woods of Vincennes, sank like a blood clot in the battery smoke, lower, lower into the blood-soaked plain. 4. When midnight sounded from the belfry of Saint-Sulpice, the gates of Paris were still choked with fragments of what had once been an army. They entered with the night, a sullen horde, spattered with slime, faint with hunger and exhaustion. There was little disorder at first, and the throng at the gates parted silently as the troops tramped along the freezing streets. Confusion came as the hours passed. Swiftly and more swiftly, crowding squadron after squadron and battery on battery, horses plunging and caissons jolting, the remnants from the front surged through the gates, a chaos of cavalry and artillery struggling for the right of way. Close upon them stumbled the infantry. Here a skeleton of a regiment marching with a desperate attempt at order, there a riotous mob of mobiles crushing their way to the streets, then a turmoil of horsemen, cannon, troops without officers, officers without men, then again a line of ambulances, the wheels groaning under their heavy loads. Dumb with misery, the crowd looked on. All through the day the ambulances had been arriving, and all day long the ragged throng whimpered and shivered by the barriers. At noon the crowd was increased tenfold, filling the squares about the gates and swarming over the inner fortifications. At 4 o'clock in the afternoon the German batteries suddenly wreathed themselves in smoke, and the shells fell fast on Montparnasse. At 4:20, two projectiles struck a house in the Rue de Bac, and a moment later the first shell fell in the Latin Quarter. Braith was painting in bed when West came in, very much scared.
"I wish you would come down. Our house has been knocked into a cocked hat, and I'm afraid that some of the pillagers may take it into their heads to pay us a visit tonight."
Braith jumped out of bed and bundled himself into a garment which had once been an overcoat. "Anybody hurt?" he inquired, struggling with a sleeve full of dilapidated lining. "No. Colette is barricaded in the cellar, and the concierge ran away to the fortifications. There will be a rough gang there if the bombardment keeps up. You might help us."
"Of course," said Braith.
But it was not until they had reached the Rue Serpente and had turned in the passage which led to West's cellar that the latter cried, "Have you seen Jack Trent today?"
"No," replied Braith, looking troubled.
"He was not at ambulance headquarters."
"He stayed to take care of Sylvia, I suppose."
A bomb came crashing through the roof of a house at the end of the alley and burst in the basement, showering the street with slate and plaster. A second struck a chimney and plunged into the garden, followed by an avalanche of bricks, and another exploded with a deafening report in the next street. They hurried through the passages to the steps which led to the cellar. Here again Braith stopped.
"Don't you think I had better run up to see if Jack and Sylvia are well entrenched? I can get back before dark."
"No. Go in and find Colette, and I'll go."
"No, no, let me go. There's no danger."
"I know it," replied West calmly, and dragging Braith into the alley, pointed to the cellar steps. The iron door was barred.
"Colette! Colette!" he called.
The door swung inward, and the girl sprang up the steps to meet them. At that instant, Braith, glancing behind him, gave a startled cry, and pushing the two before him into the cellar, jumped down after them and slammed the iron door. A few seconds later, a heavy jar from the outside shook the hinges.
"They are here," muttered West, very pale.
"As that door," observed Colette calmly, "will hold forever."
Braith examined the low iron structure, now trembling with the blows rained on it from without. West glanced anxiously at Colette, who displayed no agitation, and this comforted him.
"I don't believe they will spend much time here," said Braith. "They only rummage in cellars for spirits, I imagine,
unless they hear that valuables are buried there."
"But surely nothing is buried here," exclaimed Braith uneasily.
"Unfortunately there is," growled West. "That miserly landlord of mine." A crash from the outside, followed by a yell, cut him short. Then blow after blow shook the doors until there came a sharp snap, a clinking of metal, and the triangular bit of iron fell inwards, leaving a hole through which struggled a ray of light. Instantly West knelt, and shoving his revolver through the aperture, fired every cartridge. For a moment the alley resounded with the racket of the revolver. Then absolute silence followed. Presently a single questioning blow fell upon the door, and a moment later another and another, and then a sudden crack zigzagged across the iron plate. "Here," said West, seizing Colette by the wrist. "You follow me, Braith." And he ran swiftly toward the circular spot of light at the farther end of the cellar. The spot of light came from a barred manhole above. West motioned Braith to mount on his shoulders. "Push it over. You must." With little effort, Braith lifted the barrel cover, scrambled out on his stomach, and easily raised Colette from West's shoulders.
"Quick, old chap," cried the latter.
Braith twisted his legs around a fence chain and leaned down again. The cellar was flooded with a yellow light, and the air reeked with the stench of petroleum torches. The iron door still held, but a whole plate of metal was gone. And now, as they looked, a figure came creeping through holding a torch.
"Quick," whispered Braith. "Jump!"
And West hung dangling until Colette grasped him by the collar and he was dragged out. Then her nerves gave way and she wept hysterically, but West threw his arms around her and led her across the gardens into the next street, where Braith, after replacing the manhole cover and piling some stone slabs from the wall over it, rejoined them. It was almost dark. They hurried through the street, now only lighted by burning buildings or the swift glare of the shells. They gave wide berth to the fires, but at a distance saw the flitting forms of pillagers among the debris. Sometimes they passed a female fury, crazed with drink, shrieking anathemas upon the world, or some slouching lout whose blackened face and hands betrayed his share in the work of destruction. At last they reached the Seine and passed the bridge, and then Braith said, "I must go back. I am not sure of Jack and Sylvia." As he spoke, he made way for a crowd which came trampling across the bridge and along the river wall by the D'Orsay barracks. In the midst of it, West caught the measured tread of a platoon. A lantern passed, a file of bayonets, then another lantern which glimmered on a deathly face behind, and Colette gasped, "Hartman!" and he was gone. They peered fearfully across the embankment, holding their breath. There was a shuffle of feet on the quay, and the gate of the barracks slammed. A lantern shone for a moment at the postern. The crowd pressed to the grill, then came the clang of the volley from the stone parade. One by one the petroleum torches flared up along the embankment, and now the whole square was in motion. Down from the Champs-Élysées and across the Place de la Concorde straggled the fragments of the battle, a company here and a mob there. They poured in from every street, followed by women and children, and a great murmur, borne on the icy wind, swept through the Arc de Triomphe and cut down the dark avenue. Perdu, perdu. A ragged end of a battalion was pressing past, the specter of annihilation. West groaned. Then a figure sprang from the shadowy ranks and called West's name, and when he saw it was Trent, he cried out. Trent seized him, white with terror. "Sylvia?" West stared speechless, but Colette moaned.
"Oh, Sylvia, Sylvia, they are shelling the quarter."
"Trent!" shouted Braith, but he was gone, and they could not overtake him. The bombardment ceased as Trent crossed the Boulevard Saint-Germain, but the entrance to the Rue de Seine was blocked by a heap of smoking bricks. Everywhere the shells had torn great holes in the pavement. The café was a wreck of splinters and glass, the bookstore tottered, ripped from roof to basement, and the little bakery, long since closed, bulged outward above a mass of slate and tin. He climbed over the steaming bricks and hurried into the Rue de Tournon. On the corner a fire blazed, lighting up his own street, and on the blank wall beneath a shattered gas lamp, a child was writing with a bit of cinder, "Here fell the first shell." The letters stared him in the face. The rat killer finished and stepped back to view his work, but catching sight of Trent's bayonet, screamed and fled, and as Trent staggered across the shattered street, from holes and crannies in the ruins, fierce women fled from their work of pillage, cursing him. At first he could not find his house, for the tears blinded him, but he felt along the wall and reached the door. A lantern burned in the concierge's lodge, and the old man lay dead beside it. Faint with fright, he leaned a moment on his rifle, then, snatching the lantern, sprang up the stairs. He tried to call, but his tongue hardly moved. On the second floor he saw plaster on the stairway, and on the third the floor was torn, and the concierge lay in a pool of blood across the landing. The next floor was his, theirs. The door hung from its hinges, the walls gaped. He crept in and sank down by the bed, and there two arms were flung around his neck and a tear-stained face sought his own. "Sylvia! Oh, Jacques, Jacques, Jacques!" From the tumbled pillow beside them a child wailed.
"They brought it. It is mine," she sobbed.
"Ours," he whispered, with his arms around them both. Then from the stairs below came Braith's anxious voice. "Trent, is all well?" The Street of Our Lady of the Fields.
Et tous les jours passés la tristesse nous sont comptés comme des jours heureux.
1. The street is not fashionable, neither is it shabby. It is a pariah among streets, a street without a quarter. It is generally understood to lie outside the pale of the aristocratic Avenue de l'Observatoire. The students of the Montparnasse Quarter consider it swell and will have none of it. The Latin Quarter from the Luxembourg, its northern frontier, sneers at its respectability and regards with disfavor the correctly costumed students who haunt it. Few strangers go into it. At times, however, the Latin Quarter students use it as a thoroughfare between the Rue de Rennes and the Boulier. But except for that and the weekly afternoon visits of parents and guardians of the convent near the Rue Vavin, the street of Our Lady of the Fields is as quiet as a Passy boulevard. Perhaps the most respectable portion lies between the Rue de la Grande Chaumière and the Rue Vavin. At least this was the conclusion arrived at by the Reverend Joel Byram, as he rambled through it with Hastings in charge. To Hastings, the street looked pleasant in the bright June weather, and he had begun to hope for its selection when the Reverend Byram shied violently at the cross on the convent opposite. "Jesuits," he muttered. "Well," said Hastings wearily, "I imagine we won't find anything better. You say yourself that vice is triumphant in Paris, and it seems to me that in every street we find Jesuits or something worse." After a moment he repeated, "Or something worse, which of course I would not notice, except for your kindness in warning me." Dr. Byram sucked in his lips and looked about him. He was impressed by the evident respectability of the surroundings. Then, frowning at the convent, he took Hastings's arm and shuffled across the street to an iron gateway which bore the number 201 bis, painted in white on a blue ground. Below this was a notice printed in English. 1. For porter, please oppress once. 2. For servant, please oppress twice. 3. For parlor, please oppress thrice. Hastings touched the electric button 3 times, and they were ushered through the garden and into the parlor by a trim maid. The dining room door just beyond was open, and from the table in plain view, a stout woman hastily arose and came toward them. Hastings caught a glimpse of a young man with a big head, and several snuffy old gentlemen at breakfast, before the door closed and the stout woman waddled into the room, bringing with her an aroma of coffee and a black poodle.
"It is a pleasure to you receive," she cried. "Monsieur is English? No? American? Of course. My pension it is for Americans surtout. Here all speak English, c'est-à-dire the personnel. The servants do speak, plus ou moins a little. I am happy to have you comme pensionnaire."
"Madam," began Dr. Byram, but was cut short again.
"Ah, yes, I know. Ah, mon Dieu, you do not speak French, but you have come to learn. My husband does speak French with le pensionnaire. We have at the moment a family American who learn of my husband French."
Here the poodle growled at Dr. Byram and was promptly cuffed by his mistress.
"Veux-tu?" she cried with a slap. "Veux-tu? Oh, le vilain! Oh, le vilain!"
"Mais, madame," said Hastings, smiling,
"il n'a pas l'air très féroce."
The poodle fled, and his mistress cried,
"Ah, the accent charming! He does speak already French like a Parisian young gentleman."
Then Dr. Byram managed to get in a word or two, and gathered more or less information in regard to prices.
"It is a pension sérieux. My clientèle is of the best, indeed a pension de famille, where one is at home."
Then they went upstairs to examine Hastings's future quarters, test the bedsprings, and arrange for the weekly towel allowance. Dr. Byram appeared satisfied. Madame Marotte accompanied them to the door and rang for the maid, but as Hastings stepped out into the gravel walk, his guide and mentor paused a moment and fixed Madame with his watery eyes. "You understand," he said, "that he is a youth of most careful bringing up, and his character and morals are without a stain. He is young and has never been abroad, never even seen a large city. And his parents have requested me, as an old family friend living in Paris, to see that he is placed under good influences. He is to study art, but on no account would his parents wish him to live in the Latin Quarter if they knew of the immorality which is rife there. A sound like the click of a latch interrupted him, and he raised his eyes, but not in time to see the maid slap the big-headed young man behind the parlor door. Madame coughed, cast a deadly glance behind her, and then beamed on Dr. Byram.
"It is well that he come here. The pension more serious. Il non existe pas. It is not any," she announced with conviction.
So, as there was nothing more to add, Dr. Byram joined Hastings at the gate. "I trust," he said, eyeing the convent, "that you will make no acquaintances among Jesuits." Hastings looked at the convent until a pretty girl passed before the gray facade, and then he looked at her. A young fellow with a paint-box and canvas came swinging along, stopped before the pretty girl, said something during a brief but vigorous handshake at which they both laughed, and he went his way, calling back, "À demain, Valentine!" As in the same breath, she cried, "À demain!" "Valentine," thought Hastings. "What a quaint name." And he started to follow the Reverend Joel Byram, who was shuffling toward the nearest tramway station.
2. "And you are pleased with Paris, Monsieur Estang?"
demanded Madame Marat the next morning, as Hastings came into the breakfast room of the pension, rosy from his plunge in the limited bath above. "I am sure I shall like it," he replied, wondering at his own depression of spirits. The maid brought him coffee and rolls. He returned the vacant glance of the big-headed young man, and acknowledged diffidently the salutes of the snuffy old gentleman. He did not try to finish his coffee, and sat crumbling a roll, unconscious of the sympathetic glances of Madame Marotte, who had tact enough not to bother him. Presently a maid entered with a tray on which was balanced 2 bowls of chocolate, and the snuffy old gentleman leered at her ankles. The maid deposited the chocolate at a table near the window and smiled at Hastings. Then a thin young lady, followed by her counterpart in all except years, marched into the room and took the table near the window. They were evidently American, but Hastings, if he expected any sign of recognition, was disappointed. To be ignored by compatriots intensified his depression. He fumbled with his knife and looked at his plate. The thin young lady was talkative enough. She was quite aware of Hastings's presence, ready to be flattered if he looked at her. But on the other hand, she felt her superiority, for she had been 3 weeks in Paris, and he, it was easy to see, had not yet unpacked his steam trunk. Her conversation was complacent. She argued with her mother upon the relative merits of the Louvre and the Bon Marché, but her mother's part of the discussion was mostly confined to the observation, "Why, Susie!" The snuffy old gentleman had left the room in a body, outwardly polite and inwardly raging. They could not endure the Americans, who filled the room with their chatter. The big-headed young man looked after them with a knowing cough, murmuring, "Gay old birds." To this Mr. Bladen smiled and said, "They've had their day," in a tone which implied that he was now having his.
"And that's why they all have baggy eyes," cried the girl. "I think it's a shame for young gentlemen—" "Why, Susie," said the mother, and the conversation lagged.
After a while Mr. Bladen threw down the Petit Journal, which he daily studied at the expense of the house, and turning to Hastings started to make himself agreeable. He began by saying, "I see you are an American." To this brilliant and original opening, Hastings, deadly homesick, replied gratefully, and the conversation was judiciously nourished by observations from Miss Susie Bing, distinctly addressed to Mr. Bladen. In the course of events, Miss Susie, forgetting to address herself exclusively to Mr. Bladen, and Hastings replying to her general question, the entente cordiale was established, and Susie and her mother extended a protectorate over what was clearly neutral territory.
"Mr. Hastings, you must not desert the pension every evening as Mr. Bladen does. Paris is an awful place for young gentlemen, and Mr. Bladen is a horrid cynic."
Mr. Bladen looked gratified. Hastings answered,
I shall be at the studio all day, and I imagine I shall be glad enough to come back at night.
Mr. Bladen, who at a salary of $15 a week acted as agent for the Pewley Manufacturing Company of Troy, New York, smiled a skeptical smile and withdrew to keep an appointment with a customer on the Boulevard Magenta. Hastings walked into the garden with Mrs. Bing and Susie, and at their invitation sat down in the shade before the iron gate. The chestnut trees still bore their fragrant spikes of pink and white, and the bees hummed among the roses trellised on the white-walled house. A faint freshness was in the air. The watering carts moved up and down the streets, and a clear stream bubbled over the spotless gutters of the Rue de la Grande Chaumière. The sparrows were merry along the curbstones, taking bath after bath in the water and ruffling their feathers with delight. In a walled garden across the street, a pair of blackbirds whistled among the almond trees. Hastings swallowed the lump in his throat, for the song of the birds and the ripple of water in the Paris gutter brought back to him the sunny meadows of Millbrook.
"That's a blackbird," observed Miss Bing. "See him there on the bush with pink blossoms. He's all black except his bill, and that looks as if it had been dipped in an omelette, as some Frenchman says."
"Why, Susie," said Mrs. Bing.
"That garden belongs to a studio inhabited by two Americans," continued the girl serenely, "and I often see them pass. They seem to need a great many models, mostly young and feminine."
"Why, Susie!"
"Perhaps they prefer painting that kind, but I don't see why they should invite five, with three more young gentlemen, and all get into two cabs and drive away singing. This street," she continued, "is dull. There is nothing to see except the garden and a glimpse of the Boulevard Montparnasse through the Rue de la Grande Chaumière. No one ever passes except a policeman. There is a convent on the corner."
"I thought it was a Jesuit college," began Hastings, but was at once overwhelmed with a Baedeker description of the place, ending with,
"On one side stand the palatial hotels of Jean-Paul Laurent and Guillaume Bougereau, and opposite, in the little passage Stanislas, Carolus Duran paints the masterpieces which charm the world."
The blackbird burst into a ripple of golden, throaty notes, and from some distant green spot in the city, an unknown wild bird answered with a frenzy of liquid trills, until the sparrows paused in their ablutions to look up with restless chirps. Then a butterfly came and sat on a cluster of heliotrope and waved his crimson-banded wings in the hot sunshine. Hastings knew him for a friend, and before his eyes there came a vision of tall mullins and scented milkweed alive with painted wings, a vision of a white house and woodbine-covered piazza, a glimpse of a man reading and a woman leaning over the pansy bed, and his heart was full. He was startled a moment later by Miss Bing.
"I believe you are homesick."
Hastings blushed. Miss Bing looked at him with a sympathetic sigh and continued,
"Whenever I felt homesick at first, I used to go with Mama and walk in the Luxembourg Gardens. I don't know why it is, but those old-fashioned gardens seem to bring me nearer home than anything in this artificial city." "But they are full of marble statues," said Mrs. Bing mildly. "I don't see the resemblance myself."
"Where is the Luxembourg?" inquired Hastings after a silence.
"Come with me to the gate," said Miss Bing.
He rose and followed her, and she pointed out the Rue Vavin at the foot of the street.
"You pass by the convent to the right," she smiled,
and Hastings went. 3. The Luxembourg was a blaze of flowers. He walked slowly through the long avenues of trees, past mossy marbles and old-time columns, and threading the grove by the bronze lion, came upon the tree-crowned terrace above the fountain. Below lay the basin shining in the sunlight. Flowering almonds encircled the terrace, and in a greater spiral, groves of chestnuts wound in and out and down among the moist thickets by the western palace wing. At one end of the avenue of trees, the observatory rose, its white domes piled up like an eastern mosque. At the other end stood the heavy palace, with every window pane ablaze in the fierce sun of June. Around the fountain, children and white-capped nurses armed with bamboo poles were pushing toy boats, whose sails hung limp in the sunshine. A park policeman, wearing red epaulettes and a dress sword, watched them for a while, and then went away to remonstrate with a young man who had unchained his dog. The dog was pleasantly occupied in rubbing grass and dirt into his back while his legs waved in the air. The policeman pointed at the dog. He was speechless with indignation.
"Well, Captain," smiled the young fellow.
"Well, Monsieur Student," growled the policeman.
"What do you come and complain to me for?"
"If you don't chain him, I'll take him," shouted the policeman.
"What's that to me, mon capitaine?"
"What? Isn't that bulldog yours?"
"If it was, don't you suppose I'd chain him?"
The officer glared for a moment in silence, then deciding that, as he was a student, he was wicked, grabbed at the dog, who promptly dodged. Around and around the flower beds they raced, and when the officer came too near for comfort, the bulldog cut across a flower bed, which perhaps was not playing fair. The young man was amused, and the dog also seemed to enjoy the exercise. The policeman noticed this and decided to strike at the fountainhead of the evil. He stormed up to the student and said, "As the owner of this public nuisance, I arrest you."
"But," objected the other, "I disclaim the dog."
That was a poser. It was useless to attempt to catch the dog until three gardeners lent a hand, but then the dog simply ran away and disappeared in the Rue de Medici. The policeman shambled off to find consolation among the white-capped nurses, and the student, looking at his watch, stood up yawning. Then, catching sight of Hastings, he smiled and bowed. Hastings walked over to the marble, laughing.
"Why, Clifford," he said, "I didn't recognize you."
"It's my mustache," sighed the other. "I sacrificed it to humor a whim of a friend." "What do you think of my dog?"
"Then he is yours," cried Hastings.
"Of course. It's a pleasant change for him, this playing tag with policemen. But he is known now, and I'll have to stop it. He's gone home. He always does when the gardeners take a hand. It's a pity. He's fond of rolling on lawns."
Then they chatted for a moment of Hastings's prospects, and Clifford politely offered to stand his sponsor at the studio.
"You see, old Tabby, I mean Dr. Byram, told me about you before I met you," explained Clifford. "And Elliot and I will be glad to do anything we can."
Then, looking at his watch again, he muttered,
"I have just 10 minutes to catch the Versailles train, au revoir," and started to go, but catching sight of a girl advancing by the fountain, took off his hat with a confused smile. "Why are you not at Versailles?" she said, with an almost imperceptible acknowledgment of Hastings's presence.
I'm going," murmured Clifford.
For a moment they faced each other, and then Clifford, very red, stammered,
"With your permission, I have the honor of presenting to you my friend, Monsieur Hastings."
Hastings bowed low. She smiled very sweetly, but there was something of malice in the quiet inclination of her small Parisienne head.
"I could have wished," she said, "that Monsieur Clifford might spare me more time when he brings with him so charming an American."
Must I go, Valentine?" began Clifford.
"Certainly," she replied.
Clifford took his leave with very bad grace, wincing when she added,
"And give my dearest love to Cécile."
As he disappeared in the Rue d'Assas, the girl turned as if to go, but then suddenly remembering Hastings, looked at him and shook her head.
"Monsieur Clifford is so perfectly hare-brained," she smiled. "It is embarrassing sometimes. You have heard, of course, all about his success at the Salon."
He looked puzzled, and she noticed it.
"You have been to the Salon, of course?"
"Why, no," he answered. "I only arrived in Paris 3 days ago." She seemed to pay little heed to his explanation, but continued,
"Nobody imagined he had the energy to do anything good, but on varnishing day the Salon was astonished by the entrance of Monsieur Clifford, who strolled about as bland as you please with an orchid in his buttonhole, and a beautiful picture on the line."
She smiled to herself at the reminiscence and looked at the fountain.
"Monsieur Bougereau told me that Monsieur Julien was so astonished that he only shook hands with Monsieur Clifford in a dazed manner, and actually forgot to pat him on the back. Fancy," she continued with much merriment, "fancy Papa Julien forgetting to pat one on the back."
Hastings, wondering at her acquaintance with the great Bougereau, looked at her with respect.
"'May I ask,' he said diffidently, "'whether you are a pupil of Monsieur Bougereau?'
"'I?' she said in some surprise.
Then she looked at him curiously. Was he permitting himself the liberty of joking on such short acquaintance? His pleasant, serious face questioned hers.
"'Tiens,' she thought, "'what a droll man!'
"'You surely study art,' he said. She leaned back on the crooked stick of her parasol and looked at him.
"'Why do you think so?'
"'Because you speak as if you did.'
"'You are making fun of me,' she said, "'and it is not good taste.'
She stopped, confused, as he colored to the roots of his hair.
"'How long have you been in Paris?' she said at length.
3 days,' he replied gravely.
"'But, surely you are not a nouveau? You speak French too well.'
Then after a pause,
"'Really, are you a nouveau?'
"'I am,' he said. She sat down on the marble bench lately occupied by Clifford, and tilting her parasol over her small head, looked at him.
"'I don't believe it.'
He felt the compliment, and for a moment hesitated to declare himself one of the despised. Then, mustering up his courage, he told her how new and green he was, and all with a frankness which made her blue eyes open very wide and her lips part in the sweetest of smiles.
"'You have never seen a studio?'
"'Never.
Nor a model?
No.'
"'How funny,' she said solemnly.
Then they both laughed. "'And you,' he said, "'have seen studios?'
"'Hundreds.'
"'And models?'
"'Millions.'
"'And you know Bougereau?'
"'Yes. And Henna and Constant and Laurent and Puvis de Chavannes and Dagan and Courtois and all the rest of them.'
"'And yet you say you are not an artist.'
"'Pardon,' she said gravely.
"'Did I say I was not?' "'Won't you tell me?' he hesitated. At first she looked at him, shaking her head and smiling. Then of a sudden her eyes fell, and she began tracing figures with her parasol in the gravel at her feet. Hastings had taken a place on the seat, and now, with his elbows on his knees, sat watching the spray drifting above the fountain jet. A small boy dressed as a sailor stood poking his yacht and crying,
"'I won't go home!'
His nurse raised her hands to heaven. Just like a little American boy, thought Hastings, and a pang of homesickness shot through him. Presently the nurse captured the boat, and the small boy stood at bay.
"'Monsieur René, when you decide to come here, you may have your boat.'
The boy backed away, scowling.
"'Give me my boat, I say,' he cried. "'And don't call me René, for my name's Randall, and you know it.'
"'Hello,' said Hastings. "'Randall? That's English.'
"'I am American,' announced the boy in perfectly good English, turning to look at Hastings. "'And she's such a fool she calls me René because Mama calls me Ranny.'
Here he dodged the exasperated nurse and took up his station behind Hastings, who laughed, and catching him around the waist, lifted him into his lap. "'One of my countrymen,' he said to the girl beside him. He smiled while he spoke, but there was a queer feeling in his throat.
"'Don't you see the stars and stripes on my yacht?' demanded Randall.
Sure enough, the American colors hung limply under the nurse's arm.
"'Oh!' cried the girl. "'He is charming!' and impulsively stooped to kiss him.
But the infant Randall wriggled out of Hastings' arms, and his nurse pounced upon him with an angry glance at the girl. She reddened and then bit her lips as the nurse, with eyes still fixed on her, dragged the child away and ostentatiously wiped his lips with her handkerchief. Then she stole a look at Hastings and bit her lip again. "'What an ill-tempered woman,' he said. "'In America most nurses are flattered when people kiss their children.' For an instant she tipped the parasol to hide her face, then closed it with a snap and looked at him defiantly.
"'Do you think it's strange that she objected?'
"'Why not?' he said in surprise. Again she looked at him with quick, searching eyes. His eyes were clear and bright, and he smiled back, repeating, "'Why not?'
"'You are droll,'
she murmured, bending her head. "'Why?' But she made no answer and sat silent, tracing curves and circles in the dust with her parasol. After a while, he said, "'I am glad to see that young people have so much liberty here. I understood that the French were not at all like us.
You know, in America, or at least where I live in Millbrook, girls have every liberty. Go out alone and receive their friends alone, and I was afraid I should miss it here. But I see how it is now, and I am glad I was mistaken.
She raised her eyes to his and kept them there. He continued pleasantly, "Since I have sat here, I have seen a lot of pretty girls walking alone on the terrace there, and then you are alone, too. Tell me, for I do not know French customs, do you have the liberty of going to the theater without a chaperone?"
For a long time she studied his face, and then, with a trembling smile, said, "Why do you ask me?"
"Because you must know, of course," he said gaily.
"Yes," she replied indifferently. "I know."
He waited for an answer, but getting none, decided that perhaps she had misunderstood him. "I hope you don't think I mean to presume on our short acquaintance," he began. "In fact, it is very odd, but I don't know your name. When Mr. Clifford presented me, he only mentioned mine. Is that the custom in France?"
"It is the custom in the Latin Quarter," she said, with a queer light in her eyes. Then suddenly she began talking almost feverishly. "You must know, Monsieur Hastings, that we are all un peu sans gêne here in the Latin Quarter. We are very bohemian, and etiquette and ceremony are out of place. It was for that Monsieur Clifford presented you to me with small ceremony, and left us together with less. Only for that I am his friend, and I have many friends in the Latin Quarter, and we all know each other very well, and I am not studying art, but
what?" he said, bewildered.
"I shall not tell you. It is a secret," she said with an uncertain smile.
On both cheeks a pink spot was burning, and her eyes were very bright.
Then in a moment her face fell. "Do you know Monsieur Clifford very intimately?"
"Not very." After a while she turned to him, grave and a little pale.
"My name is Valentine, Valentine Tissot. Might I ask a service of you on such very short acquaintance?"
"Oh," he cried, "I should be honored."
"It is only this," she said gently. "It is not much. Promise me not to speak to Monsieur Clifford about me. Promise me that you will speak to no one about me."
"I promise," he said, greatly puzzled. She laughed nervously.
"I wish to remain a mystery. It is a caprice. But," he began,
"I had wished, I had hoped, that you might give Monsieur Clifford permission to bring me, to present me at your house."
My house," she repeated.
"I mean, where you live, in fact, to present me to your family." The change in the girl's face shocked him.
"I beg your pardon," he cried. "I have hurt you."
And as quick as a flash, she understood him, because she was a woman.
"My parents are dead," she said.
Presently he began again, very gently.
"Would it displease you if I beg you to receive me?"
"Is it the custom?"
"I cannot," she answered.
Then glancing up at him,
"I am sorry. I should like to. But believe me, I cannot."
He bowed seriously and looked vaguely uneasy.
"It isn't because I don't wish to. I like you. You are very kind to me."
"Kind?" he cried, surprised and puzzled.
"I like you," she said slowly. "And we will see each other sometimes, if you will."
"At friends' houses?"
"No, not at friends' houses."
"Where?" "Here," she said with defiant eyes. "Why," he cried, "in Paris you are much more liberal in your views than we are." She looked at him curiously.
"Yes, we are very bohemian."
"I think it is charming," he declared.
"You see, we shall be in the best of society,"
she ventured timidly, with a pretty gesture toward the statues of the dead queens ranged in stately ranks above the terrace. He looked at her, delighted, and she brightened at the success of her innocent little pleasantry.
"Indeed," she smiled, "I shall be well chaperoned, because you see we are under the protection of the gods themselves. Look, there are Apollo and Juno and Venus on their pedestals," counting them on her small gloved fingers, "and Ceres, Hercules, but I can't make out."
Hastings turned to look up at the winged god under whose shadow they were seated.
"Why, it's love," he said.
4. "There is a nouveau here," drawled Lavitt.
leaning around his easel and addressing his friend Bowles. "There is a nouveau here who is so tender and green and appetizing that heaven help him if he should fall into a salad bowl." "Hayseed?" inquired Bowles, plastering in the background with a broken palette knife and squinting at the effect with approval. "Yes. Squee-dunk or Oshkosh, and how he ever grew up among the daisies and escaped the cows, heaven alone knows." Bowles rubbed his thumb across the outlines of his study to throw in a little atmosphere, as he said, glared at the model, pulled at his pipe, and finding it out, struck a match on his neighbor's back to relight it. "His name," continued Laffitt, hurling a bit of bread at the hat rack, "his name is Hastings. He is a berry. He knows no more about the world," and here Mr. Laffitt's face spoke volumes for his own knowledge of that planet, "than a maiden cat on its first moonlight stroll." Bowles, now having succeeded in lighting his pipe, repeated the thumb touch on the other edge of the study and said, "Ah, yes," continued his friend, "and would you imagine it, he seems to think that everything here goes on as it does in his damned little backwoods ranch at home. Talks about the pretty little girls who walk alone in the street. Says how sensible it is, and how French parents are misrepresented in America. Says that for his part he finds French girls, and he confesses to only knowing one, as jolly as American girls. I tried to set him right. I tried to give him a pointer as to what sort of ladies walk about alone or with students, and he was either too stupid or too innocent to catch on. Then I gave it to him straight, and he said I was a vile-minded fool and marched off." "Did you assist him with your shoe?" inquired Bowles, languidly interested. "Well, no. He called you a vile-minded fool." "He was correct," said Clifford from his easel in front. "What? What do you mean?" demanded Laffitt, turning red. "That," replied Clifford. "Who spoke to you? Is this your business?" sneered Bowles, but nearly lost his balance as Clifford swung about and eyed him. "Yes," he said slowly. "It's my business." No one spoke for some time. Then Clifford sang out, "I say, Hastings!" And when Hastings left his easel and came around, he nodded toward the astonished Laffitt. "This man has been disagreeable to you, and I want to tell you that any time you feel inclined to kick him, why, I will hold the other creature." Hastings, embarrassed, said, "Why, no. I don't agree with his ideas, nothing more." Clifford said, "Naturally," and slipping his arm through Hastings's, strolled about with him and introduced him to several of his own friends, at which all the nouveaux opened their eyes with envy, and the studio were given to understand that Hastings, although prepared to do menial work as the latest nouveau, was already within the charmed circle of the old, respected, and feared, the truly great. The rest finished, the model resumed his place, and work went on in a chorus of songs and yells and every ear-splitting noise which the art student utters when studying the beautiful. 5 o'clock struck. The model yawned, stretched, and climbed into his trousers, and the noisy contents of 6 studios crowded through the hall and down into the street. 10 minutes later, Hastings found himself on top of a Montrouge tram, and shortly afterward was joined by Clifford. They climbed down at the Rue Gay-Lussac. "I always stop here," observed Clifford. "I like the walk through the Luxembourg." "By the way," said Hastings, "how can I call on you when I don't know where you live?" "Why, I live opposite you." "What, the studio in the garden where the almond trees are and the blackbirds?" "Exactly," said Clifford. "I'm with my friend Elliot." Hastings thought of the description of the 2 American artists which he had heard from Miss Susie Bing and looked blank. Clifford continued, "Perhaps you had better let me know when you think of coming so that I will be sure to be there," he ended rather lamely. "I shouldn't care to meet any of your model friends there," said Hastings, smiling. "You know, my ideas are rather straight-laced. I suppose you would say puritanical. I shouldn't enjoy it, and wouldn't know how to behave." "Oh, I understand," said Clifford, but added with great cordiality, "I'm sure we'll be friends, although you may not approve of me and my set, but you will like Severn and Selby because, well, they are like yourself, old chap." After a moment he continued,
There is something I want to speak about. You see, when I introduced you last week in the Luxembourg to Valentine...
Not a word, cried Hastings, smiling. You must not tell me a word of her.
Why?
No, not a word, he said gaily. I insist. Promise me upon your honor you will not speak of her until I give you permission. Promise.
I promise, said Clifford, amazed.
She is a charming girl. We had such a delightful chat after you left, and I thank you for presenting me, but not another word about her until I give you permission.
Oh, murmured Clifford.
Remember your promise, he smiled as he turned into his gateway.
Clifford strolled across the street, and traversing the ivy-covered alley, entered his garden. He felt for his studio key, muttering, I wonder. But of course he doesn't. He entered the hallway, and fitting the key into the door, stood staring at the two cards tacked over the panels. Foxhall Clifford, Richard Osborne Elliot. Why the devil doesn't he want me to speak of her? He opened the door, and discouraging the caresses of two brindle bulldogs, sank down on the sofa. Elliot sat smoking and sketching with a piece of charcoal by the window. Hello, he said, without looking around. Clifford gazed absently at the back of his head, murmuring, I'm afraid that man is too innocent. I say, Elliot, he said at last, Hastings, you know, the chap that old Tabby Byram came around here to tell us about, the day you had to hide Colette in the armoire.
Yes, what's up?
Oh, nothing. He's a brick.
Yes, said Elliot, without enthusiasm.
Don't you think so? Demanded Clifford.
Why, yes. But he is going to have a tough time when some of his illusions are dispelled.
More shame to those who dispel him.
Yes. Wait until he comes to pay his call on us, unexpectedly, of course. Clifford looked virtuous and lighted a cigar.
I was just going to say, he observed, that I have asked him not to come without letting us know, so I can postpone any orgy you may have intended.
Ah! Cried Elliot indignantly. I suppose you put it to him that way.
Not exactly, grinned Clifford.
Then more seriously, I don't want anything to occur here to bother him.
He's a brick, and it's a pity we can't be more like him.
I am, observed Elliot complacently, only living with you.
Listen, cried the other. I have managed to put my foot in it in great style. Do you know what I've done? Well, the first time I met him in the street, or rather it was in the Luxembourg, I introduced him to Valentine.
Did he object?
Believe me, said Clifford solemnly, this rustic Hastings has no more idea that Valentine is
Valentine,
than he has that he himself is a beautiful example of moral decency in a quarter where morals are as rare as elephants.
I heard enough in a conversation between that blackguard Laffitte and the little immoral eruption Bowles to open my eyes.
I tell you, Hastings is a trump. He's a healthy, clean-minded young fellow, bred in a small country village, brought up with the idea that saloons are way stations to hell.
And as for women...
Well, demanded Elliot.
Well, said Clifford, his idea of the dangerous woman is probably a painted Jezebel.
Probably, replied the other.
He's a trump, said Clifford, and if he swears the world is as good and pure as his own heart, I'll swear he's right.
Elliot sat smoking and turned to his sketch, saying, he will never hear any pessimism from Richard Osborne E.
He is a lesson to me, said Clifford.
Then he unfolded a small perfumed note, written on rose-colored paper, which had been lying on the table before him. He read it, smiled, whistled a bar or two from Miss Helliet, and sat down to answer it on his best cream-laid notepaper. When it was written and sealed, he picked up his stick and marched up and down the studio two or three times, whistling.
"Going out?" inquired the other without turning.
"Yes," he said, but lingered a moment over Elliot's shoulder, watching him pick out the lights in his sketch with a bit of bread. "Tomorrow is Sunday," he observed after a moment's silence.
"Well," inquired Elliot,
"have you seen Colette?"
"No. I will tonight. She and Rowden and Jacqueline are coming to Boulogne's. I suppose you and Cecile will be there?"
"Well, no," replied Clifford. Cecile dines at home tonight, and I had an idea of going to Mignon's.
Elliot looked at him with disapproval.
You can make all the arrangements for La Roche without me, he continued, avoiding Elliot's eyes.
What are you up to now?